Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. The Chicago-based activist Jason Perez will talk about defunding and or abolishing the police. And Bill Moyer will talk about how serious investment in railroads could ameliorate a lot of our climate problems. Last week, Michael Utrecht and Megan Day offered some criticisms of the call to defund the police and lamented the lack of organization coming out of last summer's Black Lives Matter protests. I got some criticism for this, so in the spirit of open debate, here's a different perspective from Jason Perez, a Chicago-based anti-cop activist. Jason was on Behind the News several years ago to talk about the Black Youth Project 100. Here he is to argue that talking about abolition isn't the kiss of death, politically, and that there really is serious organization behind the agenda. Jason Perez. I'm sure you know the criticisms of the call to defund or abolish the police. Defund criticism is that it's vague and sort of slides into abolition, which is unpopular with the broad public. How do you react to that kind of argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's kind of like two trains, right? There's like the liberal train of the criticism, which is like, whatever, right? Liberals are going to liberal. But I think the left one always throws me off a little bit. I don't think there's anything wrong with defund being associated with abolition, right? I think the job of good organizing is to ensure that the demand lives on, and not even less the demand, but like the organizational capacity lives on so that then it actually turns into policies that are meaningful in people's lives. Medicare for all at times for parts of the public is considered socialism, right? And supposedly the Warren argument to why Bernie was ineffective was that he was a socialist and openly identified as a socialist. So then that's why, and that whole kind of progressive wing was that's why Bernie can never win or whatever. You know, when we measure a demand or a slogan just slowly based on, is it too close to like the radical edge? You know, I don't think that's necessarily like the best metric. It should be a metric, but I don't think this should be like the primary metric in terms of how we're measuring. We should be measuring it of, does it galvanize popular support? Does it galvanize, I think, especially organizing support of constituency organizations for people to like spend time in, campaign in, do the things that require organizing? And then also, yeah, is it reaching some level of a broader audience outside of narrow activist world or narrow whatever world, you know? And at least from my time and doing like abolition organizing, like defund is one of those things that, similar to what Medicare for All has done or Green New Deal has done or Fight for 15 has done, allows you to be whatever your radical persuasion is, still be able to push for something defund, where then the person doesn't necessarily have to be an abolitionist in order to support it, you know, and the tenets of like that are under defund.
Actually, that's something I've thought about, that whatever reservations I have about the call, I'm not sure if it makes much difference in practical terms. People who support abolition would have a lot in common with people who are really serious about serious reforms of the police. That's not necessarily a dividing line with people who are working on actual issues on the ground.
Yeah, that's what I think some of the criticism, you know, like I think it starts falling into, I think people's understandings of what mass politics are or what popular demands are versus, you know, like a maximum popular program versus a minimum popular program. And we can have debates upon debates on that. But, you know, what matters is it moving people in terms of organizing? And then obviously, is it moving people in terms of legislative support or like policy, genuine policy reform? And I think defund has had successes in that area, and then defund hasn't had successes in the area. And I think, I guess my concern is, like, at least on the left, in terms of always going over, thinking that the message itself is somehow the problem. Yeah, I don't think that's a problem. It's like a movement that's like fairly young, you know. Being on the focus is then we miss a whole organizing conversation of how we should be organizing better, how it can build up on the wins, how we can build this thing so that it's more durable. So I feel like we're just not having the right conversation because we're constantly talking about, does it work or does it not? It's here. It's kind of like when there was like that back and forth about, I think, like single payer and public option back in the day. And it's just, you know, it's just one of those things where you're having these conversations and it's like, what do they matter unless like a moment happens where then it redefines everything and then you're going to have to organize under those conditions anyways, you know?
I think one argument is that these calls were much more popular last summer and they've lost some of their popularity now. Do you perceive that in any of your work?
Yeah, defund always had like maybe 40% at most, or like, you know, it was never like, you know, majoritarian in that sense. And then, you know, like, yeah, divest, invest, it's more popular in that way. I think that's fine. I mean, we were doing divest, invest for a long, long time, you know, before this moment, and it wasn't resonating. People weren't doing it, right? So I don't think there's anything stopping anybody from doing divest, invest. You know, I think connected to like that loss, that drop in polling is like, you know, the argument that then it's because of like right wing attacks. But I, you know, it for sure right wing attacks, but it's also like it's also an issue of like progressive Democrats, you know, such as Sanders, such as the Squad, and then also a consequence of labor, like not getting behind any semblance of defund or being like, this is the context we're going to work in, you know, like around healthcare, right? Everyone is agreed on it's going to be some version of Medicare for all or single payer. Whereas on, you know, on the police reform level, right, it's still a lot of that camp is still on what you would call liberal police reforms that don't really and are not even committed to a divest invest. Right. I'm definitely not saying, you know, Sanders could easily just say, yeah, I believe in divest invest and we need to do that. And that doesn't happen. And so when those like formal institutional left is not doing those things, that also causes defund itself, the label defund itself, to not poll as well. You know, what does that mean locally? Here we're following like, you know, kind of radical flank theory, you know, the idea that by having a demand that's that much on the edge, it'll make other things like what people call a divest invest or other reforms more possible, but at least able to cut off what I would call liberal police reforms. And polling is just a tool, right? It gives us some context. But when Sanders was cratering on Super Tuesday, right? Like, I don't think anyone was just like, it's time to throw out Sanders and like get us a new person or something. You know, like that's just like, I don't quite understand, you know, like there's for sure time for reflection and different approaches to organizing. I don't know if it necessarily means you throw it out because of the slogan.
Also, it seems to me very practical politics that even if you're like a moderate reformist of some sort, you need radicals really to push the realm of possible outwards.
And usually you need people who are, I mean, you need radicals and you also need people who are wanting to actively organize for free, usually, who want to do this kind of work, you know, and usually the demands that get people a little bit more excited do that, you know, versus the ones that are more poll tested and that kind of speak to those kind of things. Also, too, I think the idea is that for some on the left, they try to measure like what a social movement demands and it being popular or not popular versus like what electoral demands are, things that emerge out of electoral politics or out of labor. And those are two different types of ways you understand what success is and ability for success. You know, like the civil rights movement actually didn't have some of their policies or their demands were at times popular, but for the most part, their tactics, their demands, and their policies were not actually popular, but then they're still able to win like aspects of them and elements of them. And then the same goes for, you know, something like ACT UP also, right? Which was, I wouldn't call that mass politics, but these weren't things that were popular that ACT UP was fighting for. And I'm not trying to say that what ACT UP achieved was structural reforms, but the meaningful reforms that they did achieve weren't popular, but were able to still be implemented at some level. And so I think we don't want to fall into like every spontaneous moment, you know, or like there will be action moment, like, you know, it is somehow the renewal of the left, you know, like with sometimes what happens with when we see movement moments like we saw last summer, you know, but we also don't want to fall into this thing that if it's not in this like, you know, neat cookie cutter kind of formal set of politics that we see out of like electoral work or even socialist electoral work, then that means it's not working or it's not effective or that it needs to fit into that approach to change or theory of change.
Yeah, it seems like we also need a division of labor. We need people who are working in electoral politics. We need people who are working outside it. I don't see that these things should necessarily be in opposition. They can feed on each other.
Yeah, they don't have to always follow like the same kind of sloganeering or phrasing or talking points or whatever, you know. There should be coordination, obviously, and some, you know, overlap, you know, but it doesn't have to be looked upon in that manner.
Okay, so if you're organizing, you know, maybe when people go door to door and talk to people, I presume we'll be able to do that again sometime. You come across somebody and you talk about abolition or, you know, defunding, and they go, well, somebody says, well, I don't know, you know, we need cops, a lot of bad people out there. I really don't think this is practical. What kind of response do you have to somebody who's skeptical in that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly similar to when stuff with Bernie was happening, and usually the pushback with Bernie was less of that, yes, Medicare for all sounds good. It was more of the pushback was, but it's not possible. He'll never be able to do it. With abolition and defund, you know, I don't push them on saying, oh, you need to believe in abolition, right? And I for myself, when I'm door knocking or canvassing, don't lead with that. What I do lead with is like, hey, look at your neighborhood, right? Like, anytime you need to call someone, right, it's usually always someone who has to be a police officer. And even then, they don't come when they're supposed to. Meanwhile, we have crises that don't require police. We have schools that need to be funded. You know, you just go through the various public services that folks actually want. For us, we have like a little chart they can see and they can look at, you know, and see like how much police are getting versus like affordable housing, mental health services, you know. And during the time of COVID, of course, it was like money for rental assistance, things like that. And then you walk them through it like, hey, wouldn't it be better if like we were investing in these things instead of investing in police? It's fairly practical like that. It's not any more mystical like that. I mean, there's for sure folks who then are more interested in the defund side and abolition side. And if they bring that up and they're like, and they push that, then you go with it. But within canvassing and door knocking conversations, once you build on and explain with folks what defund is, the understanding is there. And there's moments, you know, you meet with folks who want to talk about abolition. And for me, it's usually Black folks. So it goes into interesting places. You do that. And I mean, and obviously, right, the canvas, I think for myself, right, like the canvassing operation, the door-to-door operations, that is actually what should help inform you about where, quote unquote, a slogan is going, a message is going, all that other kind of stuff, you know, versus like, oh, I saw a poll, it's not doing whatever.
Yeah, I'm curious, when you're talking to people who are outside the bubble that we live in the left, is there recognition of the abolition agenda? Do people understand it? Are they aware of it?
Yeah, nowadays, yeah. Yeah, that's the biggest difference, right? Then even from like when we do like more like divest, invest stuff, even a few years back, like after Ferguson and stuff. Yeah, there is an understanding of abolition. Some people hem and haw on it. Some people give a version of abolition that's still more defund than abolition, you know, and you're like, all right, cool. Like, you know, let's talk about it. Let's, you know, just like people with socialism will be like, socialism is Medicare for all and versus like owning the means of production and et cetera, et cetera. So that has been probably the biggest difference, at least this year, is that just people either identifying or then being able to like have a conversation about what they think abolition is or isn't and their thoughts on it.
I'm speaking with the Chicago-based anti-police activist Jason Perez. Now, there's also a critique of BLM, abolition, police reform, that there was this great spontaneous eruption last summer. Riots, demonstrations with huge numbers participating. Gallup says 10% of American adults participated in a Black Lives Matter demonstration of some sort last summer. And then that all disappeared, that there's been no organizational results of that. Nothing has taken organizational form. Is that true? Is that fair? Is that relevant?
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I'm a member of DSA, right? And there's a lot of strong, flourishing, you know, defund campaigns, like working groups in our chapters. You know it yourself. You know, the New York City Council just pledged to do like, you know, defund by $3 billion over 2 years. And that came from the defund work going on in New York. And there's been several wins of the actual campaigns. I think at the campaign level, most defund organizing work is, at least for me, I would make a pretty clear distinction between BLM or whatever that is or means versus what defund organizing is. And that defund organizing is definitely far closer to what we would understand as abolition and an abolition political tradition.
You know, I think those things get all blended together. So could you make the distinctions for the listeners?
Yeah. So, I mean, BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter, I mean, organizationally, right, Black Lives Global Network, Movement for Black Lives, right, which is like a Movement for Black Lives is like a coalition of organizations. Black Lives Global Network is, at this point, almost like a funder, a bit basically. And so a lot of organizations affiliated with that, right, do seed and do defund work or versions of defund work. But some of them do like police reform kind of work or believe in, you know, like do community oversight type of work and things like that, right? Whereas defund and what you saw with the proliferation of like organizational formations is that people actually making defund campaigns in their city. So Seattle has its own like defund campaign where DSA members of groups affiliated with Black Lives Matter, other progressives, right, are all part of this campaign. And then they do, you know, a year round form of a budget campaign. That's what we have in Chicago. From what I understand, that's what's happening in New York. And I would say that defund work is far more anchored by the organizing that's happened, preceded by like folks like Critical Resistance, Miriam Kaba, Ruth Gilmore. So it's far more rooted in that, I would say. The organizational form, I know my Working Family Party affiliate has a defund group that works and that does organizing around it. I know my DSA chapter does. I know other local community organizations that have that and that do that. I think the expectation for like one big organization to come out of one specific moment is, I think it's like a mismeasure of what a moment should be or not. I don't think anyone would argue that DSA's membership roles grew a lot after that moment. So I see the organizational capacity there, and a good way to kind of understand organizational capacity is to see, like, after the moment dies down, right? After the moment of eruption dies down, how much can people still get some semblance of successful wins and then restart their projects after, like, you know, you've had a die down moment. And I see that organizational capacity there and ability there, you know, like I'm not trying to do the, you know, anti-globalization movement of movements kind of thing. Like, you know, I'm not trying to make that argument. Like, you know, these wins come from traditional, really boring budget campaigns, you know, like it's some of the boringest organized, you know, like I used to try to get people to go to budget hearings before, like when I was doing labor work, it was like pulling teeth, you know, even from members.
Well, like, that's like the very definition of boring.
Yeah. And here you had a bunch of people involved in it, you know, like, I mean, it was, and it was a lot of young folks too, but it was also intergenerational. And so I don't know what they mean by like types of organizations, or that like another new DSA was supposed to form or something. I don't know what that means or doesn't mean. Yeah.
DSA has been criticized some for not having been deeply involved enough in these sorts of issues. You think that's a fair criticism?
Yeah. You know, and I know I'm in the Chicago bubble, and then I know a lot of New York people, so then maybe I'm in those two bubbles of DSA, so that I don't see it in the same way, you know?
Well, like, that's a lot of people, though.
Yeah, right. That is. I'm not trying to get in trouble with comrades. But yes, it is a lot of people, and we should all do our things equitably. I'm just trying to sustain myself. So, I mean, I feel like those two chapters did it great and did it like how it's supposed to be done in terms of making that the focal point. I know in Chicago, like our leadership made sure that like defund was the focal of our work, was the main thing, like right after Bernie. And we still have that committee. We're still doing good work. At a national level, yeah, could we have coordinated better? But I mean, come on, like we could have coordinated better on Medicare for All or Green New Deal. You know, I mean, that's kind of larger internal stuff within DSA, if that makes any sense.
These calls to defund and abolish might seem somewhat abstract. So what kinds of practical things are you working on in Chicago or that you know of elsewhere, like that really would make a difference in the way policing is done?
The paradigmatic example right now is like what Seattle was able to accomplish. I think it was like around, I think the first half was like 25%, and then it's going to be another 25%. And then the money gets allocated through a participatory budget process. Obviously, they're trying to claw that back and undermine it, I would argue with any kind of progressive municipal demand that you have. So, you know, you have to keep organizing on that. So at least for us in Chicago, that's the blueprint that we want to follow. Having a proposal that pushes for 75 to 50% defund over 5 years, and then having a participatory budget process where community members can then invest in things like healthcare, affordable housing, things like that. I think in Chicago also, it's more money significantly, like having divesting from police and putting money into violence prevention programs. And then a program from Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez, Treatment Not Trauma, which is like, you know, alternative, like a crisis responder model that sends out mental health workers instead of police. Those are the main things. I don't know if that's still too abstract or not.
No, that's quite real. If you start talking about taking money away from cops and spending it on better pursuits, that's very real and very effective. Finally, for someone who has plenty of problems with the structures of American unions, and we could go on for a very long time about what those might be, it's all still very hard to take an anti-union position against police unions. They're really bad actors in a lot of ways. But for someone who is just sort of instinctively pro-union, if it comes to a either-or kind of question, it's a little difficult to say police unions are bad and should be abolished. So how do you deal with somebody who, like, with that kind of instinctive pro-labor position, but nonetheless has to confront just how awful police unions are?
I'm not necessarily on, like, the Bill Fletcher side of things of, like, you know, AFL-CIO has to first deal with its own racism before it can do anything to police. Like, you know, I personally don't think that what's impeding even liberal police reforms are police unions, right? I don't believe that, right? I think it's far more police foundations and the corporations that give to them. And then, you know, structural incentives with like elected officials that make it so. If people want to go after police unions like that, I mean, just to go after a target, for sure you should. But I you know, I don't think that's the source of what is policing power or like why liberal or abolitionist demands can't get passed. You know, I just don't. I think that we need better organizing. We need far more force. We need way more elected officials that support defund. And, you know, we need far more mass protests that go after, you know, corporations like Google. You know, and the list can kind of go on of all those folks who like support police, pay for police. Yeah, I think that's where our power lies. And I feel that way about the qualified immunity thing too. Like, I don't think that qualified immunity, even on the terms of what necessarily, I guess, liberals want in terms of reform or reducing police violence will make that happen. And also too, there's some folks who say like, oh, well, then the union contract doesn't even allow you to defund it. That's just not true. I mean, you can have a layoff schedule that allows you to just, you know, it might make the process a little bit longer, the unwinding of it, but you can still defund over a 5 to 7 year period.
Well, if you listen to the police propagandists, cops are retiring in droves because we're being so mean to them.
Right, exactly. And then you just don't rehire, right? You just don't have, you know, like most serious defund proposals, even from like folks like Miriam or Ruth Gilmore, it's an attrition model that like, you know, allows time enough to build up the social services and capacity that would be a counterforce to policing in general. So yeah, that's where I'm at on the police unions thing.
That was Jason Perez, a Chicago-based activist working to defund the police. Jason Perez noted that the early civil rights movement didn't poll well. Is that ever true? For example, in 1961, Gallup asked, do you think sit-ins at lunch counters, freedom buses, and other demonstrations by Negroes will hurt or help the Negroes' chances of being integrated in the South? That's Gallup's 1961 language, not mine. 57% said hurt, and just 27% said help. In 1962, they found 42% saying JFK was pushing too hard on racial integration. In 1964, Gallup asked, do you think mass demonstrations by Negroes are more likely to help or more likely to hurt the Negroes' cause for racial equality? Almost three-quarters of respondents, 74%, said hurt, and just 16% said help. In 1965, 48% of respondents approved of laws in 19 states that made interracial marriage a crime. Political agitation does change minds. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after musical break. How some of Police State by the UK Subs. Next, railroads. Much of our freight moves on trucks, which are dirty energy hogs. Moving all that freight onto rails would reduce carbon and other foul emissions, as well as reducing traffic deaths. An investment in the rail infrastructure could improve passenger transport as well. But it would take serious investment and policy changes for that to happen. Here's a man with a plan for that, Bill Moyer, director of the Solutionary Rail Project. Sadly, not enough attention is being paid to these issues. Here's Bill Moyer to make the case. Let's just lay out the landscape as it is now. What share of freight traffic does rail carry, or does truck traffic really dominate in that field?
Well, truck traffic dominates clearly across all distance bands, and it will continue to have an important role. The area of freight transport that we've particularly concerned ourselves around is long-haul freight, freight that's traveling over 500 miles in particular. What is the public interest in terms of how is that freight moved? And what are the impacts of the mode choice for moving that freight? And we're of the position that that freight is doing far more harm, and we are failing as a society to leverage the efficiencies of rail when that long-haul freight is traveling on trucks. And across the country, about 40% of our long-haul, over 500-mile freight is traveling on trucks rather than trains.
Does truck have a cost advantage over rail?
Sometimes truck has a cost advantage over rail, but another consideration for shippers is reliability. And trucks have a reliability advantage that is being increased by the failure of the railroads to maintain their standards of shipping and their capacity, and a bias for high profit margin freight at the cost to shippers and society.
What are the relative ecological merits or demerits of the two modes?
Anything that's traveling on a road is taking about 3 times more energy, no matter what the motive power for that vehicle is. It's taking, you know, it's burning 3 times more diesel, or it's taking 3 times as much electricity just because of the mere friction involved with rubber tires on roads, pavement, rather than a steel wheel on tracks. So the energy efficiency is an important element, especially as we're talking about decarbonizing both our transportation and our energy infrastructure. But there are also additional costs. Trucking is going to lower their emissions. They're going to increase their gas mileage, and eventually they'll electrify. Now, the electrification of those trucks, especially in those long distances, is unlikely to come in anytime soon.
Electrifying those trucks will help, but not really be transformative, right?
No, it's not going to transform the situation and the timeline that we need. We have approximately 2 million trucks in this country. And so the cost of electrifying all those trucks is too great, and it's going to happen in too such a slow manner to actually protect communities, et cetera. Though electrification is something that we should be working toward, and electrification of trucking is a priority, we're going to be stuck with these long-haul trucks for running on diesel for a good long time. But as your question implies, even if we were able to electrify the long-haul trucks in a speedy manner, society would still pay a number of other costs. Wear and tear on our roads and infrastructure is considerable from heavy trucks. They do thousands of times more damage. Any one truck does thousands of times more damage than a single car. The congestion costs are estimated in the U.S. at $166 billion. That's the Texas Transportation Institute. The other costs are just efficiency. Trucks are going to take more electricity, even just like they take more diesel, to move freight on those long distances. And so if we have a trillion ton miles of freight in this country traveling on trucks at distances over 500 miles, it's the solutionary rail position that freight has no business being on trucks in the first place. It's far more efficient to put that freight onto tracks and get those trucks off the road. And that will be a savings in any number of ways, from the wear and tear costs to the access road safety to the health, public health costs of diesel in communities to et cetera, et cetera.
How well can our existing rail infrastructure handle a significant increase in freight of the sort you're talking about?
We'd have to make major investments. If we really were going to commit to a massive mode shift to get this dirtier freight, the less efficient long-haul freight off of roads and onto tracks, we would likely have to double the amount of utilization. And obviously, that's going to require a significant increase in track capacity, et cetera. Honestly, it's going to take a lot of innovations. It's going to take probably everything from on-dock rail improvements for ports to have on-dock rail so that they reduce the drayage. It's going to require likely some roll-on, roll-off technology for places where we aren't doing intermodal, but we're actually getting trucks onto the trains. And more than anything else, I think it's going to take a public policy position that railroads are critical national infrastructure.
Now, these railroads now, as they exist, are corporations that are driven by profit. It sounds like they have to be a little more public-spirited than they might want to be on their own. Now, how do you envision this happening politically?
When we did our book in 2016, I naively had this thought that, of course, any business that you're offering to engage in a partnership with to increase their market share, isn't that what business is all about? We thought that, wow, the railroads would be on board with that. What we found out, though, is the railroads have been captured by a business model that has nothing to do with growing market share. It has everything to do with lowering operating ratios. And so in a sense, when we need a partner, a rail industry that's willing to engage in the investments and the collaboration with the public sector to increase capacity, increase utilization, increase the service level with reliability and faster, rapid service, et cetera. What we have is we have a railroad industry that is actually mining 170 years of private and public investment, from land grants to bailouts that we've made of the railroads in the last number of decades, and to maximize shareholder value and shareholder profits in the short term. And that's exactly the wrong direction for our society in a time when we have major climate and social and economic objectives and public goods to serve. And we have this national infrastructure, this interstate rail infrastructure that's completely unaligned with public goods and not harmonized with the rest of our infrastructure, like our national highway system.
You're talking about large investments as well, and I'm not sure that the railroads as they currently exist have either the capacity or the willingness to make those investments. So how do you envision that happening?
Honestly, Doug, I think we have a fight in front of us. The railroads are actually chasing shippers away currently. If they're not the most profitable shipper, they're chasing them to move their goods by truck. So we've got shippers like Kinder Morgan complaining about monopolistic practices of the railroads. We've got shippers like the Grain and Feed Association, U.S. Grain and Feed Association, complaining about and asking for the Surface Transportation Board to clarify the common carrier obligations of the railroads. So I think fundamentally, that is a very important first step, is we have to, as a society, and this is where I think the left should be leading the way, is clarify, what do we want from these monopolies who've been allowed to operate in that privileged monopolistic space? What is the trade-off? What does the society get for that? And if we don't get anything, then why on earth are we allowing private corporations to run our interstate infrastructure?
You mentioned Kinder Morgan. That's a name that jumps out. They're heavily involved in, or were, I think, in the Canadian tar sands, right? So the railroads have been very deeply involved in moving around a lot of filthy fossil fuel.
Yeah, I mean, that gets right back to the origins of our project. The Solutionary Rail Project evolved from our engagement in resistance to coal export terminals and oil bomb trains moving tar sands oil and Bakken fuel and Powder River Basin coal through the Pacific Northwest, where we're based, to Asia. So we felt it, you know, was extremely offensive, the idea that this beautiful Pacific Northwest could be a national sacrifice zone as a corridor to power factories in China. And then, of course, and, you know, ship back stuff and acidify oceans, et cetera. So the shipping of fossil fuels and the dependency of the railroads in shipping fossil fuels has been part of the problem. Now, also part of the problem has been that the railroads have been an active participant in funding climate denial, partially because of that codependent relationship they have with coal and moving oil.
Well, that's really perverse, though, because you think they could advertise that they're more environmentally friendly than other forms of surface transportation, but they're taking the wrong side of the politics.
Right. Well, they do. They advertise that they're part of the sustainable. You listen to BNS, if you're in the Pacific Northwest, you hear on NPR, BNSF talking about its climate-friendly freight practices and that it's, you know, the climate-friendly transportation company. But in reality, yeah, they've been a part of our nemesis in regards to dealing with climate. There's a lot of greenwashing that comes from the Association of American Railroads and the Class I railroads. That's what's going to make this tangled knot so difficult to untangle. They are losing their coal. It was approximately 30% of their business, not just a few years ago. So as coal goes away, you would think they would be wanting to replace it. But instead, what they're doing is they're reducing their capacity so that they don't have to maintain the infrastructure that they have. And instead of finding new customers and encouraging a shift of transport freight off of trucks and onto tracks.
Now, we've been talking mostly about freight, but your idea of a revived and expanded railroad system would also be able to move people around, right? How did the passenger travel fit into your picture?
The railroads used to be, part of their common carrier obligation was to provide passenger service, right? And then they were released of that in 1970. And so you could consider 1970 and 1971 when we created Amtrak as a very important bailout of the railroad industry. Their common carrier obligations obliged them to maintain services to communities, passenger services to communities that weren't actually profitable to them. But that was part of the deal because they were given land, they were allowed to operate as monopolies, and they had obligations to the society because of that privileged space. So when we created Amtrak, we also obliged the freight to yield to passenger trains, but that was never really enforced. And so passenger service for Amtrak became subject to a lot of delays. So certainly increasing capacity, investing in fast lanes for rapid freight and scheduled freight will also, of course, increase capacity and reduce delay times and congestion for passengers. So passengers are an important ally in this struggle, but the orientation, because of the ownership model in the US, the orientation is by default dealing with these freight railroads, these private corporations.
I'm speaking with Bill Moyer, Executive Director of Solutionary Rail. Now, when people talk about passenger rail or reviving or transforming passenger rail, they think of really, you know, fast trains on the Japanese or the Chinese or the French model. You're not really talking about that, right?
We're really not talking about that. And actually, as a person engaged in progressive movement for many years, you know, certainly when I was asked about trains and rail policy in the past, of course, my first response was to say, oh, we want to be like those other countries. We want to have bullet trains. Well, you know, that's when I didn't know squat about railroads. And I didn't really understand this system that we have. And I think that that's part of what I'm hoping from progressives is that we up our game in terms of the way that we think about rail in the US and its relationship to moving people and goods. There's an example in Washington State where for 30 years we studied, what do we do with this north-south corridor from Vancouver to Portland? And the study determined that the optimum speed is 110 miles per hour because it allows you to stop at all these communities in between, and it decreases the travel time between Seattle and Portland to less than 2.5 hours, and similarly to Vancouver, BC. The folks who did that study actually found that if they increased their maximum speed to 125 miles an hour, it nearly doubled the cost of the infrastructure improvement. So when you then try to double it to 250 miles per hour, that becomes this basically unattainable boondoggle that's going to require a bunch of eminent domain fights over decades. And who's it really going to benefit? Because we have this thing called the Cascadia Innovation Corridor that's being proposed currently by WSP, large engineering firm, and Bill Gates and Microsoft, and honestly, a bunch of other billionaires. Well, who's going to gain, right? Developers, engineering firms, and these folks who want to create some technology hubs. But regular people are not going to benefit. It's not going to do squat to get trucks off of the streets of communities or reduce the impacts of our freight system. So no, we're not talking about bullet trains. Now, places like California, where they're already going, let them finish that, whatever. But there are very few city pairs that really warrant 220 mile an hour trains. And honestly, the direction that's being taken in Europe, in some places like in Germany,
Their new fleet of trains, their top speed is 155 miles an hour, which is a lot closer to the Acela. 150 miles an hour does, when you have that as a top speed, is it allows you to use shared corridor, existing corridor that doesn't require eminent domain fights. And it gives you a way to improve that corridor to create those dedicated fast lanes so that we speed up both passenger and freight and we get trucks off the highways.
You're talking about electrifying the railroad system fully, but what about the role of railroads in transmitting clean power? Is that also a benefit of this model you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, if we were really to start from the beginning of this this Gordian knot, you know, what I would identify that we have two big problems to solve. We have the energy sector's contribution to greenhouse gases and climate change, and we have the transportation infrastructure's contributions. They're each approximately 30% nationally. So how do you deal with the toughest pieces of each one? Well, the toughest piece of transportation, land transportation, is the heavy trucks, because they're the hardest to electrify. The hardest piece to deal with in the energy sector, energy's contribution to climate, is the transmission. So there's a guy named Alexander McDonald, former NOAA scientist. He and a group did some modeling in 2016, and it got published in Nature, the journal Nature, Climate Change. Their model said, here's how you get to 80% renewables by 2030. And the model had lots of little dots for different kinds of energy generation. But the important part of the model was not the generation. The important part of the model is the transmission. We need to be able to balance the energy availability, the variability of renewable energy across weather patterns. And as we saw recently with the grid failure in Texas, we don't have that capacity right now. We don't have grids that talk to each other, that share energy across the various systems. So what we need is when the wind's blowing in Iowa and it's not blowing in Texas or it's not blowing on the Columbia Basin, for people to be able to access power from that's coming from Iowa. And when it's not blowing in Iowa, they should be able to get it from the Dakotas or Montana or Washington State or wherever. So a national grid, a national super grid, is an important step towards solving our climate crisis and doing a just transition to a decarbonized energy infrastructure. You can't do that without transmission. And the most efficient kind of transmission is high voltage DC. And regardless of which kind of transmission, the hardest part about creating transmission is the right of way to put those lines. And so one of the things that we did succeed at recently last year is to get the House Climate Action Plan to include in their discussion of national supergrid, to include prioritizing locating transmission on existing right-of-way. It's including railroads and freeways.
So basically, you'd be running a lot of cables next to the tracks, is what you mean?
Yes, next to them, under them, above them. You know, when we wrote the book, the price of buried HVDC, high voltage direct current transmission, was prohibitively expensive. It was hard to imagine how that could happen. Increasingly, the price of that has come down, as has the systems for converting that DC electricity to AC or vice versa. So I think that what's most likely feasible for a national supergrid now is to actually have buried HVDC on rail corridors. But getting access to those rights of way is another thing the railroads will fight us on. So the railroads don't want to have, I was told by a guy at UP that railroads don't want to have any agreements with the public that have strings attached.
Of course not.
Of course not, right? But what the heck? You know, I mean, these people, this is interstate infrastructure. When I didn't know squat about it and I looked at the map, honestly, I was in awe, like dumbfounded, and honestly, a little upset that we would trust this kind of infrastructure to private corporations. And I think that initial reaction was warranted.
Now, this kind of reconstruction of the rail system and, you know, the cables underneath it or alongside it, would be very, very expensive. It would involve stepping on property rights of the railroads and other private actors, but it also would require expenditures of large amounts of money to rebuild the capital infrastructure. So how do you imagine financing it? Any sense of how much this would cost and how we would pay for it?
Our original idea was that with a willing and able partner in the railroads, that the public-private partnership would include the creation of a development authority that would be a semi-public entity that could issue bonds, that could get funding from the federal government, and that entity would own the improvements on the infrastructure. It would own the transmission. It would own the electrification infrastructure. It would own the additional trackage. So that way, we begin to expand the commons, and we don't rely on private corporations to finance something that's not going to have a return on investment in a short term. It's going to have, you know, maybe a, depending upon which aspect, you know, a 15, a 20, a 30 year return on investment. So, and then the railroads and the power producers would pay to utilize that infrastructure. The railroads would pay user fees, just like they pay trackage fees. And they have these complex agreements with other railroads to share rail. That was our original idea. And I think that there's some form of that is still possible. What I'm not entirely convinced of is that that we have a partner in the private railroads, that the public need for this supergrid, for the massive mode shift off of trucks and onto rails, and the electrification of the trains themselves, I'm very skeptical whether the Class I railroads are going to engage in that kind of a partnership. This is not the time when people are counting pennies in terms of spending. So I think it's actually kind of an opportune moment to have conversations about very large infrastructure investments. Clearly, that's what's going on in the country. But to make sure that they're not just handouts to giant engineering firms and that they're doing making investments in the infrastructure that we need, not some pet corporate project, but is going to be part of the challenge. The other part of the challenge is getting from here to there in regards to the railroads. And that's why I think enforcing and clarifying what do we expect from these regulated monopolies, these common carriers, and what is their updated 21st century public interest obligations. And once we get that, then perhaps we can pressure them. If they are unwilling to be pressured, then the railroads are worth approximately $420 billion, the Class I railroads, the five Class I railroads operating in the U.S. Or based in the U.S. There are actually seven Class I railroads. There's currently a merger being proposed between Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern. So that's a different topic. But we could also start smaller. We could start with a particular corridor. We could start with, say, BNSF. And do a deal with BNSF and Warren Buffett, the benevolent billionaire who owns Berkshire Hathaway, the owner of Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, to improve their northern and their southern transcons. The northern transcon is the rail corridor from the Pacific Northwest to Chicago, going through Montana, and there's a northern and a southern route. And the southern transcon is the LA Long Beach, via Kansas City up to Chicago, that corridor. Both of those would be amazing corridors for energy transmission, for reducing wear and tear and public impacts of heavy trucks. And it would be an opportunity to do a start to finish electrification project so that you have trains running on electricity generated from renewable sources, ideally.
And finally, how much of what you're talking about is embodied in proposals making the rounds like the Green New Deal or the Biden infrastructure plan? Is any of it there?
Well, there's talk of the supergrid, but really, I think we're far behind in the conversation about mode shift and freight. Even our NGOs, groups like Union of Concerned Scientists or the Sierra Club or the NRDC, they've done some excellent work in the importance of decarbonizing transportation. But the vast majority of that work, if not all of that work, has been concentrating on small passenger vehicles and now increasingly, you know, medium-sized delivery trucks and buses and other like equipment, but very little of it has gone to solving the problem of long haul freight. And that may have to do with where the funders are at, you know, how much of that money is coming from the electric car companies. That's a complex thing. So I think that the NGOs are, and our movement needs to have a vision that we can lead with, because otherwise, if we don't, we're not going to see these sorts of these ideas making their way into the Biden infrastructure plan. And that's frustrating, honestly. That's it's frustrating because I can see from the numbers, such as that a trillion ton miles of freight is traveling on trucks going distances greater than 500 miles, and nobody's talking about that. That's 40% of our long haul freight is traveling on trucks that have, and it has no business being on trucks. But you know, when you've got shippers like was it Kinder Morgan and U.S. Grain and Feed Association, and you've got railroad labor, and you've got, you know, small towns like that town in Texas is losing the Union Pacific rail car servicing station, and you've got tribes who want to have access to transmission, and you've got the environmental justice movement that's now increasingly having an impact on policies. And then you have small towns in rural places that want to have service, that want to have access to railroads from small manufacturers. And you got farmers who want to get their wheat onto trains and want to have capacity. We've got this very impressive collage of unconventional allies who together could potentially move the dial on this, what I think is honestly a common sense proposal for putting rail and for transportation and energy infrastructure that serves the common good.
That was Bill Moyer, director of the Solutionary Rail Project. You can find out more about the project at Solutionary Rail, that's solution with an A-R-Y at the end, .org, solutionaryrail.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Helmet's cover of In the Ditch, part of the gradually emerging tribute to the Gang of Four's Andy Gill, who died last year. Till next week, bye.